Welcome to the Directions on Microsoft Briefing podcast. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor-in-chief here at Directions. I'm your host for this series of podcasts designed for those interested in the Microsoft Enterprise IT ecosystem. The Directions on Microsoft Briefing brings you the best insights from the best independent Microsoft watching firm in the business, Directions on Microsoft. Directions has been focused on providing Microsoft IT planning and negotiation information since 1992. Today's podcast is a little different from some of the others we've done. It's going to be about the roadmap for Azure, Microsoft's public cloud service, which over the past 14 years that it's been generally available, has grown exponentially. Azure currently encompasses tens, if not hundreds of services, depending on how you count a quote service. Microsoft is signing up more and more long-term multi-million dollar deals for Azure, partly due to AI. My special guest today is Directions on Microsoft analyst, Rob Sanfilippo, who coordinates our twice yearly Azure roadmaps. Rob covers Azure, GitHub, Visual Studio, and other developer tools, programming languages, and .NET. That's a lot. Before joining Directions on Microsoft, Rob worked at Microsoft for 14 years, where he designed technologies for Microsoft products and services, including Exchange Server, BizTalk Server, and Xbox Live. Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for doing this podcast today with me.
Hi, Mary Jo. Great to be here. This will be an interesting one.
Yes, I'm very intrigued about how you do this Azure roadmap thing. But before we get to that, let me ask you to give us a peek inside your brain. I want to know how you mentally organize and keep track of all the different pieces of Azure, because I myself have tried this and I don't know how to do it. So I'm curious. Everyone, I feel like, has a mental map when they think about technology. So when you're thinking about Azure, what does your mental map look like? Like, are you a PaaS guy? Are you an IaaS guy, or what?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, PaaS versus IaaS, that's a good place to start. And when the cloud became a thing, 15 years or more ago, That was what everyone was talking about. PaaS and IaaS and all these terms started to be used and new ones were being introduced. I think the PaaS versus IaaS terminology, that distinction is a lot less interesting than it was back when Azure debuted. Mm-hmm. It's not as important now. Right. The IaaS pieces in Azure, for example, they're really just Azure VMs and supporting components like virtual networks and IP addresses. And those are big services that are used in the majority of deployments, especially for lift and shift migrations. But there's much more that Azure has to offer. And so instead, I think about Azure in areas of functionality, such as compute and storage and databases, containers, networking, management, development, and others. And it goes on. There's always some activity going on in each functional area. It could be new services or just features or even just new ways to purchase that could bring savings or make Azure viable for more customer scenarios. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's how I think about Azure these days is functional areas. And that's how I break it down and look at what's going on within each of those areas.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how Microsoft is trying to organize it, too. When you look at azure.microsoft.com and you look at what services do they have, it's like by workload pretty much, right?
That's right. And, you know, that's the way we organize that Azure roadmap we do, too, is we have chapters and they're functional areas. And we've evolved those over the years to make more sense so that it can be explained to customers better. But yeah, that's the way we chop it up rather than going, oh, this is PaaS and this is IaaS or trying to classify it some other way like that.
Yeah, let's talk about the roadmap a little because I feel like Azure plays into so many different scenarios. Like it does everything from VM hosting to database hosting, storage, disaster recovery. So how do you try to stay current and how do you translate that to this twice yearly Azure roadmap that you oversee?
Yeah, you know, my first inclination is just to say that it's a secret and I can't tell, but I'll reveal some of
your secrets at least.
Yeah, time for revelations here. So there's really no magical way to do it. And we have certainly evolved, and we always think of new ways to approach this. But, you know, we work with Microsoft contacts, mm-hmm. but much of my research uses public sources, such as Microsoft documentation and blogs and conference sessions. There's the Azure updates feed. So Microsoft has this, call it a feed, which is really just a website where they keep posting very specific changes as they happen. And each team does their own little way of explaining the changes they make and giving links and such to try to give you the details on that. Mm-hmm. So you can watch that, and that gets updated probably a few times a day. Sometimes there's a big flourish of new updates when it's a certain part of the year, but you can watch that. So that's an Azure updates feed. And then there's the products list, which is more of a marketing presentation from Microsoft of all the services, and you can search through that. It's organized by category, but it's sometimes difficult to locate what's new there. So you need to be familiar with it and constantly go back to it. You know, sometimes I just have a good conversation with a co-pilot and start talking about what's new with Azure, and I love the co-pilots. But now I don't just trust all these sources. So part of my work, a big part of it, is to just go straight to Azure and work on it, actually use it to see what's there and if it works as advertised from all these other sources, and what's different about the reality versus the claims. And sometimes reality is better than what is promised, since things are evolving so quickly. Changes just happen in real times with a lot of these offerings. But often it's the opposite. The promises are yet to be delivered. So even though it's talked about in a blog or one of these other sources, when you go and look at it, it's not quite what it has claimed to be, or it's not yet completed to that level.
Yeah, and then there's the whole category. You mentioned Copilot, but there's a whole huge category of Azure AI services, right? There's Azure OpenAI, which seems to be really gaining some traction. There's all the old, formerly known as cognitive services kinds of AI services. And as we know, Microsoft partner OpenAI runs all its AI services exclusively on Azure. So, given all this work, all these Azure AI workloads, I even before that, I had heard from some customers in recent years that they had some trouble spinning up new workloads in Azure when they wanted to. And yes, you can run out of cloud capacity, contrary to popular belief. So I'm curious, you know, in your work and your own personal use of Azure and things you've read and heard and talked about with other people, do you think Microsoft's going to be able to keep up with Azure demand, given how hungry AI workloads are?
Right. Well, as we're all seeing, AI is a sector that's hungry for hardware. So you have GPUs and NPUs and storage are all critical to delivering on these AI scenarios and all that functionality. So Microsoft's investing billions to bulk up its data centers with this hardware and from vendors like NVIDIA. But it's also developing its own bespoke hardware just for Azure. So the company, created a line of processors called Maya. And these are used for AI training and inferencing for offerings such as the Azure OpenAI service and for its co-pilots. And then they also developed a line of processors called Cobalt, which uses ARM architecture. And that could increase the speed and reduce power demand and cut operating costs compared to other CPUs. So they're developing their own actual silicon chips, which is a fascinating thing because Microsoft is mostly a software company, but now they're getting really strong into hardware too.
Yeah,
at that level at least. And you know, Microsoft, beyond that, they've built out a vast number of data centers around the world for Azure and for its other online services in the past decade. And there's more than 30 or more than 60 regions, and several more are being built for Azure, and every region has multiple data centers. Right. And then beyond that physical build out, there's always improvements and efficiencies that will help demand, such as there's a recent enhancement called Azure Boost, and that offloads network and storage functions to separate hardware to improve VM performance. Mm-hmm. So It's possible that Azure demand occasionally overtakes the supply for short periods. So, you know, you hear about limitless or infinite scalability. It's obviously it's not infinite. There are limits to it.
Right.
But yeah, all these expansions and improvements are going to continue to arrive to give customers what they ask for.
Okay. Let me take a quick break right now so I can talk a little bit more about what we do here at Directions on Microsoft. And specifically, I want to talk about our Microsoft licensing boot camps, as we say, our world famous Microsoft licensing boot camps. The next virtual one of these is coming up March 11th to 15th. And if you'd rather do this in person, which I would recommend, Atlanta, May 21st to 23rd. We're going to have an in-person one. I went to the Atlanta boot camp last year, and I can say, based on my experience, the sheer volume of information and the opportunity to talk with the directions analysts in person, one-on-one, as well as with other customers, really makes this event something you will want to attend. It is the place to update and ensure your knowledge is current when it comes to Microsoft licensing. If you want to learn more, go to directionsonmicrosoft.com, or you can email info@directionsonmicrosoft.com to learn more about the boot camps, EA advisory services, and all the other different things that we offer here at Directions. Okay, back to Azure. And now I'm going to give you a quiz, Rob Sanfilippo. You know why Azure was codenamed Red Dog?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the story?
I do, although there's controversy about it. Isn't it like it was either a beer or a saloon or something with Dave Cutler back in the day, or I don't know
you're
if it was
mixing,
Ray Ozzie
you're mixing
or one of those
things
guys.
Up. You're mixing things up, but you're on the right path. So okay. Dave Cutler was involved. And beer and saloon, that was Longhorn, Red Dog. But Longhorn, Whistler, all those things. But Red Dog.
I thought those weren't those ski places?
Yeah, ski places in Whistler. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Red Dog, though, came to be because the team that originally developed Azure was riding around in a van around Silicon Valley, calling on different people, trying to get ideas about how the heck should we build a public cloud. And they passed a strip club called the Pink Poodle. And Dave Cutler, according to legend, said, that would be really funny if we named this thing that we're building Pink Poodle. And someone else said, no, because then they'll find out it was a strip club. So let's just call it Red Dog. It's almost like Pink Poodle. True story.
That tracks. Yeah, I just picture those guys riding around in like the Scooby van.
Exactly.
I can just see that. Yeah. So that's a good story, though.
It's such a good story. And then when they introduced Azure on stage, when it went GA, I remember all the guys who were on the original team were wearing red shoes, and it was a nod to Red Dog. Which I thought was
Does
pretty cool.
Does that have to do with Scott Guthrie's red shirts, or is that a
no?
Separate,
I know
he's a Star Trek thing. Right?
I know exactly.
The red
There's
shirt.
so much red, but no connection there.
Okay, well that's great trivia. It's,
little
we all
trivia
should know these
for
things.
The day. Yeah. Exactly. All right, back to more factual things. I know that you track very closely as you can Azure trends as part of your whole work around the roadmap. And we've talked a lot about the push to AI and how that's affecting Azure, but let's talk about some of the other trends. I think based on meetings we've had inside Directions on Microsoft, containerization and container orchestration comes up a lot, and it seems to be top of mind for many individuals, companies, developers who are building, quote, cloud native apps. So can you give us a little summary of like what's going on this front in particular?
Sure. Well, Docker containers, you hear about them all the time. They're the thing now, and they have been for several years, but they've become the premier way to deploy and orchestrate workloads. And they have many advantages over pure straight up VM images. So with containers, you get portability across operating systems. You get less overhead, and that improves performance. And then you have Kubernetes, which is the standard orchestration layer that's supported by many technologies. And so you hear this, you hear about Kubernetes and containers every day if you're involved with cloud. So like the other hyperclouds, Azure has brought out several services to work specifically with containers. And that starts with Azure Kubernetes Service, which enables the deployment and provisioning and automation and management of container-based applications. Then they have a Azure Container Instances Service, which lets customers just quickly deploy containers without having to manage the underlying host server infrastructure. So it's like serverless containers where that all that Azure just takes care of the infrastructure and all the other layers below it. And you just think, I want a container, and you call up on Azure Container Instances for that. Mm-hmm. And then they have the Azure Container Registry, which that helps customers or lets customers create and maintain their own private container registries with images. And so they can call on those registries to store and then deploy their container images. And then there's the newest of these container services is Container Apps. And that one simplifies this building, deploying, and managing Kubernetes clusters and applications without the need to access the Kubernetes management control plane and APIs. And so when you use that, Container Apps, you get to reduce your operational burden for all your developers and administrators, because yet again, Azure does all the work for you underneath, and it just delivers those containers for your workloads.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Another area I myself have been writing more about, and I hear a lot more about, is Azure Arc. Originally, when Arc was announced, I felt like it was all about simplifying management of Azure resources wherever they were. Like they could be on-prem, in other Microsoft clouds, in non-Microsoft clouds. But I feel like it's getting bigger now. Like Azure Arc is kind of taking on a life of its own and becoming something even more than that. It underlies a lot of different programs and services, like pay-as-you-go involves Azure Arc, and the extended security updates sometimes involve Azure Arc. Right. So, When you are thinking about Azure Arc and kind of where it is, where it's going, what would you say when customers say, what's going on with that?
Yeah, Arc's been around for 4 or 5 years now, but mm-hmm. it's really become a centerpiece for using Azure in hybrid scenarios. That's what it was really originally released mm-hmm. to do. I sometimes wonder about the name Arc. There's probably a story behind that one too, but I just think of it as like I'm picturing this arc, like this line from Azure data centers, and this big arc comes back to your on-premises or to anywhere else outside of Azure. But regardless of where the name came from, Arc, it establishes this metadata in Azure to track non-Azure assets. So it could be VMs deployed on-premises and in other clouds, and it tracks those as if they were Azure resources. Mm-hmm. So then you can manage things like your self-hosted servers using Azure services to monitor and update and do other governance on those things that are outside of Azure. And then beyond that, Arc has a set of features that allows several Azure services to be self-hosted. Now, Arc is getting a lot more important. Like you said, Microsoft is making that Arc service a requirement for some of its on-premises offerings. Mm-hmm. So it's not even an option anymore. You have to be Arc enabled to get certain things to work with on-premises offerings. And examples, like you said, the extended security updates or the ESUs, which help you use Windows Server and SQL Server for a longer period of time because you get security updates beyond their original life cycle. Mm-hmm. So in order to use these ESUs now with Windows Server and SQL Server, if they're outside of Azure, at least they have to be Arc enabled servers. Mm-hmm. Then you have, there's Azure Stack HCI, which is a flavor of Windows Server, the operating system. And that's something that's delivered through Azure, but hosted on premises. So you can use that as your OS on premises, but you need to pay for it through Azure. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you need to tether it back through Arc yet again. So mm-hmm. Arc is now becoming the service that sucks in all the other stuff that's outside of Azure, at least for Azure to control it or track it. And it's a strategic thing for Microsoft. You know, Arc is the way that they're going to really be able to keep an eye on all of Microsoft's customers' deployments, even if they're outside of Azure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of Azure Stack HCI, you gave me a nice segue there. Sure. We've been talking cloud up to this point because we're talking about Azure, but there are ways to run customer and or partner hosted Azure technologies on premises. So Azure Stack HCI, IoT Edge, things like that. I think those are also part of your Azure roadmap. So I'm curious if you've noticed or noted any new trends in that area specifically.
Right. Yeah. With the Azure roadmap, we really try to cover the gamut of Azure. So we talk about anything Azure in there, and we do go, there is more to our Azure analysis than just what we have in the roadmap, just because there's so much. And I'll tell you, every time we publish a new Azure roadmap, we print this out in hard copy, and we have a limit. We can only print 96 pages, and that's not enough. So yeah. These days, every time we have a new roadmap, we have to cut it down to fit into these 96 pages. So some of the stuff, some of the parts of Azure, we say, well, it's only online. You have to come to our website to find the whole set of Azure technologies. But we do cover the on-premises stuff, the things that for Azure, but are on-premises, like you said. And if you look at Microsoft and what they've provided to bring Azure technologies on-premises, it goes back to the early days. So it's not a recent thing. Even when they were saying, well, we're moving to the cloud, they still were thinking, okay, well, how do we bring the cloud back to on-premises? And there have been some stumbles with this, mainly because the early efforts they involved big hardware that was only feasible for a few large customers. So there was the original offering back when it was called Windows Azure, not Microsoft Azure. They had a thing called the Windows Azure Platform Appliance, and that required a tractor trailer size container to be parked at a customer site. And that was your on-premises Azure. It was this basically a trailer that had to be connected to power and networking and cooling. But then you had Azure on-premises, sort of. And I think there were like four big customers that ever used that. But that got followed up by what was originally called Stack, and now it's called Stack Hub. Again, though, that's some big pre-built server hardware that emulates portions of Azure, and you can put that on premises. The examples are always, oh, it's on an oil rig, or it's on a cruise ship that's disconnected and going all around the world. But you can still run your own Azure there. Again, though, that's Stack Hub, but that's big, that's expensive, and it's prescribed hardware. But there's been a later round of on-premises Azure offerings that can be used by most customers, and it brings Azure to many critical edge scenarios. And these include edge devices from Microsoft. So they actually give you some hardware that are made to run Azure, but it's also a bunch of software like Stack HCI. So that's the OS, but there's a thing called SQL Edge, which is a smaller version of SQL Server that connects into Azure. There's IoT Edge, which is a bunch of modules that do IoT functionality and run it off of Azure. So you can do things like some machine learning things, some other storage and analysis without having to be connected to Azure. And then there's these Arc-enabled services that I just had mentioned previously. And these are versions of Azure Database and application services that can run self-hosted with occasional connections to Azure. So one of the best examples of this is like a manufacturing facility where you need to perform split second operations on a line of equipment, let's say, where equipment has to operate in a certain way and you want to have software controlling that. Well, it's tough to travel all the way to the cloud and back to make a decision. It's tough in the way that it's going to take up time and bandwidth. Mm-hmm. So you want to run that kind of processing on premises. So you can do that with these Arc-enabled services. So they occasionally connect back to Azure for management and deployment and other monitoring, but the real-time things they need to do happen right there at the edge, and they don't have to go to Azure to make those things work.
Right.
And, you know, just I'll mention, by the way, there is another one of these big offerings that's current. It's called Modular Data Center for Azure. And that's another one of these tractor trailer based offerings that connects to satellites and to remote utilities to run Azure at a certain site location. It's only for U.S. government agencies right now, though. So I don't know if that's going to become. It's been out for several years, so I don't know if that's really going to be offered more widely. But that's a way to host Azure in remote areas too.
Okay. All right. I've got one more question for you. I want to ask you about a blog post that you did for us recently, where you talked about some of the lesser known and more unique Azure services out there. And some of these are pretty obscure, right? I had heard of some of them, but not all of them. You cited things like Cycle Cloud, Managed Lustre, Playwright Testing. So my question is, my brain's already full of all these Azure services that are more mainstream. Why should I care about these other kind of edge cases? And I don't mean edge computing here, like just these kind of like weird ones. Like why do you think customers should even care about those?
Yeah, I find these interesting just because they showcase interesting ways that Azure can be applied. You know, what can you do with a big cloud filled with such powerful hardware that's globally distributed? But, you know, for customers, I think it's worthwhile to keep up to date with these because they may spark innovation. They may be applicable to new projects and scenarios where customers weren't considering Azure, or they could just give you ideas or help you with ideas you've had before that never made it past the drawing board, whether or not it was something you were thinking about using Azure with. So it's really like if you want to brainstorm and just see what the possibilities are, take a run through these product lists of Azure and see what these more obscure services are. And it, you know, I think it's a good exercise for someone in the company, part of your center of excellence for cloud, if you have one, just to keep up to date with the whole set of what's going on with Azure, because it's just an interesting thing that could lead to different advantages and new projects.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Rob. That was really fun. A good catch up and a good look ahead.
Great. Oh, it was great to talk to you today, Mary Jo.
All right. To close, I would like to remind our listeners that they can find more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. Thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics you would like the directions analysts to cover in one of these podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me via Twitter at Mary Jo Foley. And speaking of Twitter, give us a follow at DirectionsMSFT if you want all the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information in one place. Thank you very much. Thank you.